Today is Wednesday, the 25th of August, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The leaders of the G7 say they're going to watch the Taliban closely going forward.
We agreed the legitimacy of any future government depends on the approach it now takes.
But moving forward, what are Afghanistan watchers keeping an eye on?
There'll be two things to watch. One would be the internal development in Afghanistan. The other thing to watch is the reaction of the regional power.
We'll have these stories and more next. U.S. President Joe Biden says that efforts are on track to complete evacuations from Kabul by August 31, the deadline for U.S. troops to leave Afghanistan. He made that announcement while speaking to reporters at the White House on Tuesday.
As of this afternoon, we've helped evacuate 70,700 people just since August the 14th, 75,900 people since the end of July. Just in the past 12 hours, another 19 U.S. military flights, 18 C-17s and one C-130 carrying approximately 6,400 evacuees, and 31 coalition flights carrying 5,600 people have left Kabul just in the last 12 hours. A total of 50 more flights, 12,000 more people since I updated you this morning. These numbers are a testament to the efforts of our brave service women and men, to our diplomats on the ground in Kabul, and to our allies still standing with us.
Earlier, Biden and other G7 leaders met virtually to discuss the situation in Afghanistan, with several pushing him to keep U.S. troops in the country beyond next week's deadline to facilitate the ongoing evacuation effort. The Taliban have rejected any extension of that deadline. With a week to go until Biden's deadline, tens of thousands of Western citizens and Afghans who supported U.S. efforts have pushed toward Hamid Karzai International Airport, hoping to make it through the gates and to safety of outgoing flights. Many Afghans have said that it has been difficult, if not impossible, to get past Taliban checkpoints lining the airport's perimeter. Republican House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy told reporters that the United States should not allow the Taliban to tell the U.S. when Washington will have to stop bringing Americans out.
We should stay until every single American is able to get out of Afghanistan. And we should use every recourse possible to make that happen. And we should not negotiate it. We should explain that this is what is going to happen. And anybody in our way to stop us from bringing an American out will be in danger.
Following the G7 meeting, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson told reporters that the group of seven leaders had agreed on a path moving forward as to how to engage with the Taliban.
The number one condition we're setting as G7 is that they've got to guarantee right the way through August the 31st and beyond a safe passage for those who want to come out. Now, some of them will say they don't accept that, and some of them, I hope, will see the sense of that, because the G7 has very considerable leverage, economic, diplomatic, and political.
That's something that President Biden expanded upon.
The G7 leaders and the leaders of the EU, NATO, and the UN all agreed that we will stand united in our approach to the Taliban. We agreed the legitimacy of any future government depends on the approach it now takes to uphold international obligations, including to prevent Afghanistan from being used as a base for terrorism. And we agreed that none of us are going to take the Taliban's word for it. We'll judge them by their actions, and we'll stay in close coordination on any steps that we take moving forward in response to the Taliban's behavior.
With much of the focus in Afghanistan during this past week on the evacuation efforts from Kabul's international airport, what about the country as a whole? For that discussion and more, I spoke with Ted Galen Carpenter, a senior fellow at the Cato Institute in Washington. I began our conversation by asking him how he views the overall situation in Afghanistan.
I think there's been a resistance to any kind of firm
central control in Afghanistan for a very long time. This goes back to generations, if not centuries. Tribal loyalties, clan loyalties are still much more important than any sense of national identity. And this may cause at least some problem for the Taliban going forward. Indeed, there are signs that ethnic-oriented resistance is resuming in the north of the country already. So this sense that the Taliban controls every square meter of the country is erroneous.
I wanted to ask you about the challenges facing the Taliban as they form, as they term it, the inclusive Islamic government. You mentioned the ethnic resistance in the north. What challenges do you see them trying to bring together, you know, a ruling coalition to form their new government?
Well, any central government in Afghanistan has always been akin to trying to herd cats, given the multitude of ethnic, religious, and tribal factions in the country. In addition, the U.S. Occupation certainly has had an effect on the country. There are portions of Afghanistan's population that like the idea of modernization, that are not going to be happy at all about going back and living under Sharia law. I think the Taliban may find that either it has to get extremely repressive or it needs to make accommodations, at least to a limited extent, with groups that are not going to be happy with the idea of a highly religious conservative rule. We'll see how that goes. Afghanistan should not be a high priority for the United States in any case. You know, this nation-building experiment was ill-advised from the very beginning. It was doomed from the very beginning. And the United States needs now to focus on real, serious security issues around the world in places like East Asia, not South Central Asia.
So moving forward, as someone who pays a great deal of attention to this particular corner of it, what are you keenly watching to see how things progress, whether they improve or they become a more destabilizing factor?
There'll be two things to watch. One would be the internal developments in Afghanistan. Is there going to be a measure of stability? If so, what kind? Will we see civil war, perhaps involving multiple factions, take place? Could Afghanistan become another Somalia or another Libya? And that's certainly a possibility. The other thing to watch is the reaction of the regional powers, Russia, China, Tajikistan, and a good many other countries, Iran, are looking carefully at Afghanistan. And it is very much in their interest not to have Afghanistan become a terrorist haven, not to become a cauldron of instability. So what we're going to see is regional geopolitics resume with the United States largely out of the picture. And in other words, that portion of the international system returning to some semblance of normal rather than seeing this system of U.S. domination, which is what we've seen over the last two decades.
That was the Cato Institute Senior Fellow, Ted Galen Carpenter. He was speaking to me from just outside of Austin, Texas. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Participants at a special session on the human rights situation in Afghanistan have urged the United Nations Human Rights Council to investigate abuses committed by the Taliban and to hold them accountable for their crimes. Lisa Schlein is up next.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet kicked off the proceedings. She gave a harrowing account of the many credible reports her office has received of violations committed by the Taliban against the Afghan civilian population, including summary executions and restrictions on the rights of women. She noted commitments made by the Taliban to respect the rights of women and of ethnic and religious minorities. She said they also have pledged to refrain from reprisals against Afghans who worked with the international community. She said the onus now was on the Taliban to honor those commitments.
I urge this council to take bold and vigorous action commensurate with the gravity of this crisis by establishing a dedicated mechanism to closely monitor the evolving human rights situation in Afghanistan, including in particular the Taliban's implementation of its promises with a focus on prevention.
Bachelet said united action by member states will be an important signal to the Taliban that a return to past practices will not be accepted by the international community. Shahzad Akbar, chair of the Afghanistan Independent Human Rights Commission, expressed disappointment at the Council's failure to create fact-finding missions to monitor, report, and gather evidence of past Taliban violations and abuses. She said the Council cannot conduct business as usual, considering the prospect of more unspeakable abuses by the Taliban rulers of her country.
The least the special session can do is to illustrate through actions to Afghans that they will not look away, that the world is committed to at least a credible, strong, and well-resourced mechanism to document the abuses and act as a deterrent.
Akbar called the draft resolution tabled at the special session a travesty, considering the well-documented violations and war crimes committed by the Taliban against women and girls, human rights defenders, and journalists, among others. She added Afghan activists on the ground who face direct threats to their lives demand and deserve better than the Council's tepid response.
To be frank with you, you are failing them. But now, today, not next month, not next March, you have the chance to redeem yourselves. Please take it. Please ensure the session has a credible and strong outcome.
Human Rights Watch agreed with that position. In a statement, the international rights group said there were ominous signs that UN member countries may fail to show the leadership needed. It said a text resolution drafted by Pakistan as leader of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation recommended the weakest possible response to the serious abuses unfolding now. The text, it said, did not call for an investigation or monitoring body, just a future discussion and report on the human rights situation in the country. It warned failure to act now would tarnish the Council's credibility, not just in Afghanistan, but in other human rights crises. The United Nations has not recognized the Taliban as the legitimate rulers of Afghanistan. So the ambassador to the UN in Geneva of the former Afghan government took the floor. Nasir Ahmad Andisha described the critical recent developments in his country and called for international support. He said his country must not be abandoned and forgotten by the world. He said the lives, rights, and dignity of his people depended upon that.
This is a key moment for the Human Rights Council to embrace the preventive role that it has many times spoken about. We still hope, and we urge you, that the outcome of this session delivers a strong message to all parties, including the Taliban, that abuses and violation of human rights law and international humanitarian law undermines both peace and justice and will have consequences.
U.S. Department of State Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Uzra Zeya, welcomed the Council's urgent attention to the dire human rights situation in Afghanistan. She said the protection of civilians must remain paramount. She condemned attacks on Afghans seeking to aid the U.S. and said all Afghans and foreign nationals who wish to depart must be allowed to do so safely. The U.S. joined a group of more than 60 countries that demanded the immediate cessation of targeted killings of women's rights defenders. The group also called on those in power in Afghanistan to guarantee women's and girls' rights to education, work, health, and freedom of movement. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
More than half a dozen Belarusian lawyers that were interviewed by the Reuters news agency say that their licenses were removed after defending protesters, speaking out against authorities, or resisting what they said was pressure on their profession. Reuters reporter Soroya Ali takes it from here.
Belarusian authorities have been cracking down on dissidents. They've targeted opposition politicians, journalists, and now apparently lawyers. Mikhail Kirilyuk was a lawyer in the former Soviet state. He defended anti-government protesters and publicly criticized President Alexander Lukashenko's rule. Then in October, he said he received a tip-off from a KGB affiliate telling him to flee.
Belarusian authorities will arrest me, not as an attorney at law, but as a former attorney at law.
38-year-old Kirilyuk quickly fled to Poland with his parents and children. His account fits with what more than half a dozen Belarusian lawyers say is a pattern of intimidation and suppression of attorneys by authorities. Seven lawyers interviewed by Reuters say their licenses were removed after defending protesters or speaking out against authorities. Many of them allege that authorities monitored confidential client meetings or obstructed their work. Like Kirilyuk, former lawyer Anton Gushinsky also had his license terminated.
The all-seeing eye sees everything, observes, systematizes, accumulates information, and then makes procedural decisions. We can easily turn from a subject of criminal proceedings into an object.
Reuters could not independently corroborate their assertions or the tip-off described by Kirilyuk, and Lukashenko's office did not respond to requests for comment. At least 23 Belarusian lawyers have been disbarred since last summer, according to the International Federation for Human Rights. The Justice Ministry said it has the power to terminate legal licenses in circumstances stipulated by law. It added that a number of lawyers had lost their licenses this year because they had committed, quote, gross violations of licensing legislation. A new law approved by Lukashenko in June stipulates that only candidates approved by the Justice Ministry can practice law. Some attorneys say that is intended to control their profession. Sergei Ustinov is a member of Belarusian human rights organization, the Legal Initiative.
Before August 2020, the rules of the game were clear and some legal mechanisms worked. There was no obvious torture in relation to political prisoners. Now we see the complete legal lawlessness in Belarus. The concept of law does not exist in principle.
Soroya Ali of Reuters News. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris said Tuesday China continues to coerce, to intimidate, and to make claims to the vast majority of the South China Sea. The Biden administration has made countering Chinese influence a key part of its foreign policy. China's foreign ministry spokesperson responded by saying the United States was pursuing a system in which it could willfully slander, oppress, coerce, and bully other countries and not have to pay any price. Officials in Senegal say that the former president of Chad, Hissène Habré, died while serving a life sentence for war crimes and crimes against humanity. Investigators say that Habré's 8-year rule of Chad from 1982 to 1990 was marked by a brutal crackdown on dissent in which more than 40,000 people were killed and some 200,000 others were tortured. He was tried and convicted by a special African Union-backed tribunal in Senegal in 2016. The U.S. envoy to North Korea says the United States supports humanitarian aid for North Korea regardless of progress in the country's denuclearization, but did not elaborate on what types of humanitarian aid are under consideration. The comments came at the end of his four-day visit to Seoul, where he reiterated his readiness to meet with North Korean leaders anytime, anywhere. WHO Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus urged countries to delay administering booster shots by at least 2 months during a recent visit to Budapest. He said that a priority should be given to raising vaccination rates in countries where only 1 or 2% of the population has been inoculated.
This is Science in a Minute.
A new study suggests that concentrating on the feelings of someone battling obesity may help them boost their heart health. The study by Ashling Harris, a cardiac and weight management dietitian at the Cree Heart and Stroke Center in Galway, Ireland, was presented at the recent European Society of Cardiology's Euro Heart Care ACNAP Congress 2021. In a Euro Heart Care press release, Ms. Harris says people with obesity issues who participated in Cree's 10-week Changing Lifestyle with Activity and Nutrition program, described as an uncritical and personalized lifestyle modification program, were able to improve both their cardiovascular and mental health. Ms. Harris added that there are a number of reasons for a person becoming obese, and that criticizing someone for their weight can stop them from getting the health care and advice they need. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Nigeria's government no longer has any doubts that Abubakar Jackal, the notorious leader of the Boko Haram terror group, is dead. Speaking to VOA Hausa Service reporter Grace Oyenubi, Nigeria's information minister, Lai Mohammed, made the confirmation.
Our position is that he has been reported dead and is dead.
Has there been evidence or anything of that nature?
Well, it's not easy to actually to get evidence of death of a person like Abubakar Jackal. But then going from the reports from the camp of Boko Haram itself, and going by the instability that has followed shortly after, and the struggle for secession, and the recent surrender by thousands of Boko Haram adherents, I think it's safe to assume that really, he's dead. The death was announced not by us; it was announced by Boko Haram itself. And so far, this is more than 4 or 5 months, and we've not seen any resurfacing of Abubakar Jackal. So I think it's safe to assume he's dead.
But why did it take so long for the government to give its own position about it?
Because we want to be sure he's really dead.
Reports of Shekau's death first emerged 3 months ago, with word he had been killed during a confrontation in the Sambisa forest with rival terror group Islamic State West Africa Province. Armed men in Nigeria have also attacked the Nigerian Defense Academy in Kaduna State, killing two officers and abducting a third. Timothy Abuzu has the details.
The Defense Academy's public relations officer, Bashir Mahud Jajira, confirmed what he called a security breach in a statement. He said the dead officers were a lieutenant commander and a flight lieutenant in the Navy and Air Force, respectively, while the abducted one is a major in the Army. He also said an officer who was wounded during the attack is being treated. Jajira said a search team comprising of the Army, Air Force, and other security agencies have begun a rescue mission. An unspecified number of gunmen gained entry into the Defense Academy about 1 a.m. local time Tuesday. The attack highlights the growing violence in Nigeria by criminal groups often operating in the country's northwestern region. Last week, tens of people were killed in sectarian violence in southern Kaduna State. In northwest Zamfara State, gunmen abducted some 75 people Saturday after killing at least four. The abductees are yet to be freed. Darlington Abdullahi, Vice President of the Nigerian Defense Alumni Association, explains why the attacks persist despite security forces' efforts to stem the crisis.
The forests that they are operating, they are more used to forest life than the people or than the security personnel, you know, that now have to move into some of those areas. So, and I mean, coupled with the fact that every care must be taken before you approach the forest, before you try to attack them in the take on them in the forest.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari took office in 2015 on the promise he would end widespread insecurity in the country. Last week, Buhari met with security heads and said he does not want to leave office as a failure. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Somali security forces have recaptured the town of Amara in the central Galmudug region after Al-Shabaab militants briefly took it over early Tuesday following a dawn attack. The Al-Shabaab militant attack on Amara and a subsequent roadside explosion in the same vicinity killed at least 6 people, including 4 soldiers. In addition, the United States military in Africa, which is known as AFRICOM, said it conducted a collective self-defense strike against Al-Shabaab fighters. AFRICOM says a battle damage assessment is still pending. According to a recent study, climate change has made deadly floods in Western Europe at least 20% more likely to happen. Reuters' Rosanna Philpott has that story.
The July rainfall triggered flooding that swept away houses and power lines and left more than 200 people dead, mostly in Germany. Dozens died in Belgium and thousands were also forced to flee their homes in the Netherlands. Scientists say the downpour was likely made heavier by climate change. A day of rainfall can now be up to 19% more intense in the region than it would have been had global atmospheric temperatures not risen by 2.16 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial temperatures. The study was conducted by the World Weather Attribution Scientific Consortium. Climate scientist Frederica Otto is the group's co-leader.
What used to be your 1-in-100-year event that you might have used as a benchmark to prepare your systems has changed and is now more intense. The most important lesson is really extreme weather is deadly. And we need to educate ourselves to take warning seriously.
The 39 WWA scientists conducted their analysis over a wider area spanning parts of France, Germany, Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and Switzerland. They used local weather records and computer simulations to compare the July flooding event with what might have been expected in a world unaffected by climate change. Because warmer air holds more moisture, summer downpours in this region are now 3 to 19% heavier than they would be without global warming, the scientists found. And the event itself was anywhere from 1.2 to 9 times or 20% to 800% more likely to have occurred. With extreme weather events dominating news headlines in recent years, scientists have been under increasing pressure to determine exactly how much climate change is to blame. During the last year alone, researchers found that US drought, a deadly Canadian heat wave, and wildfires across the Siberian Arctic have been worsened by a warming atmosphere. Climate scientist Ralph Toomey is from the Grantham Institute, Imperial College London.
So the fact that people are losing their lives in one of the richest countries in the world, that is truly shocking. And I think what it tells you, or tells me, is actually nowhere is safe. So if we know that there's more extreme rainfall, that can happen anywhere, anytime. And we sort of thought to ourselves, well, you know, Germany's going to be in good shape. But, you know, well, if Germany's not in good shape, who's going to be in good shape? And they clearly weren't. They were caught out. So I think it simply says to everybody that, you know, nowhere is really safe.
Rosanna Philpott of Reuters News. And finally, Rolling Stones drummer Charlie Watts has died at a hospital in London at the age of 80. News coming from his publicist. Associated Press music correspondent Margie Zaraletta has this look back at his life.
Charlie Watts was an unlikely rock star. He loved jazz and joined the Rolling Stones in the early 1960s, figuring the band would last 2 weeks. The most flash he would show on stage was a smile. Watts said in a 1993 interview he hated playing stadium shows.
You see the surrounds more than you do the band. You can't see any one of those. I'm amazed people actually go to them. I'm glad they do. I mean, it's a lucrative living for me.
I'm Archie Zaralletta.
And this has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events. You can do so 24 hours a day. Just point your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.